Income inequality has been a big issue in recent years, and the idea that the wealthiest Americans have too much power in politics helped drive support for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in last year's presidential campaign.
Our next guest says economic inequality poses a fundamental threat to representative government in the United States, and the Constitution didn't prepare us to deal with that problem.
Ganesh Sitaraman joins us now. He's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of the new book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Ganesh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to go back to the writing of our Constitution. You point out that a lot of governments, republics, when they've created constitutions, they are trying to reconcile differences between rich and poor and kind of balance those tensions. You said things were different for the founding fathers when they came up with our Constitution. How so?
Well, that's exactly right. So for most of the history of governments, from the ancient Greeks on to the 18th century and the founding of America, people were very worried about the problem of economic inequality. They worried that the rich would oppress the poor, or that the poor would try to confiscate the wealth of the rich. And the result would be strife, violence, and even revolutions. And so to deal with this instability in society, what they did is they built economic class right into the structure of government. So in England, you have the House of Lords for the wealthy and the House of Commons for everybody else. In ancient Rome, you have a patrician senate for the wealthy and a tribune of the plebs, of plebeians, for the poor and for everybody else. Our Constitution isn't like that. We don't have a tribune of the plebs. We don't have property requirements to be a senator or a congressman or even to be president of the United States. Our Constitution is radically different, and it's radically different because at the time, people believed America was surprisingly economically equal and that it would continue to be economically equal throughout our history.
You say they believe that, and when you look, and to put an asterisk on it, when you look at the white men who were voting at that period of time, was there more or less economic equality or less inequality than we saw elsewhere?
So there was, and part of the way we have to think about this is we have to imagine that we're back in the 1780s. And what's striking about this time is America is really just a small country, a set of sparsely populated settlements along the Atlantic coast. And what's striking about the new nation is how different it is from Europe. Unlike Europe, there's no feudalism in America. Unlike Europe, there's no hereditary aristocracy in America. The richest people in America, your George Washingtons, who have these plantations and big houses like Mount Vernon, are just nothing in comparison to the dukes and duchesses of England with their gigantic marble palaces. And America had one other thing. It had all this land to the west, which meant that white men, you mentioned it was only white men at the time, could become landowners and have a share and a stake in being part of the middle class as independent yeoman farmers. And so that was the idea on and the reality on which our system was based. And there's actually some economic historians who've gone back and tried to collect data on this time period. And what they find is that in 1774, right on the cusp of the American Revolution, and even including slavery, America was the most equal place in the world and, in fact, was more equal than America is today.
Now, there's a fear, and you're right, some of the founders wrote that this is great now, but if people start getting too rich, we're going to have problems. I want to fast forward a little to some of those problems. After the Civil War, rise of big corporations, large groups of factory workers on the other end of the scale, what kind of tensions did that start to create, and why didn't that Constitution we have really meet that crisis?
So it's exactly as you said. In the Gilded Age in the late 19th century, there were some big shifts. We moved from an agricultural economy and an artisanal economy to an economy of wage workers in factories. This was the big developments of industrialization. We had the closing of the frontier and the shift to people moving into cities, another big change in this time period. And these things put serious pressure on our economic system because the idea of a country that had land ownership that was spread across and that would be the dominant form of wealth was shifting in the age of the factory where most people didn't have land. They were wage workers. So that was a fundamental change. And people were very worried that the increasing inequality inequality that was emerging in this time period because of corporations, their shareholders, and the owners of these big enterprises having more and more wealth, that this would threaten our republic. It would threaten our constitutional system. And they saw this in terms of bribery, which was happening rampantly across state legislatures and in the federal government as well. And they worried about how this was skewing policies to support the wealthy. And so populists and progressives tried to take action to change our constitutional system and our economic system in order to revive the basic understanding of what it meant to have a representative democracy.
Talking to Ganesh Sitaraman, his new book is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. And then, Ganesh, you write that the progressives and ultimately the New Dealers did help flatten things out and kind of avert this crisis of either a wealthy oligarchs taking over or a rebellion against those oligarchs leading to tyranny.
That's exactly right. So in the populist and progressive eras around the turn of the 20th century, we really did two things as a country. The first is that we tried to reform the economy. We invented antitrust laws to break up big concentrations of corporate power. We passed a constitutional amendment for an income tax so people with a greater ability to pay would pay more. On the political side, we passed the first campaign finance regulations. We also passed a constitutional amendment for the direct election of U.S. senators rather than the selection of U.S. senators by state legislatures where there was a lot of corruption going on. And those changes were designed to create both an economic democracy and a political democracy in America. And they were largely successful, such that by the end of World War II, coming out of World War II, we ended up with an era of great prosperity and growth and a rising middle class.
I've been fast-forwarding through history a little bit because I wanted to get to today. Take us from where you just were, you know, not equal economically across the country, but relatively flat to where we are now. What happened? How did things start diverging?
Well, so what happened is in the period after World War II, we really invested in the kinds of things that would allow for a large and growing middle class. On the one hand, we had regulations in place that curtailed the kind of bad behavior at the very top. We had Glass-Steagall separating investment banking from depository banking. We had a Securities and Exchange Commission to go after bad actors in the financial sector. But we also invested in building a middle class through the GI Bill, which sent a generation to college, infrastructure spending like the highways, which both created jobs and expanded commerce across the country. We did these things to build the middle class, and it really worked for that period of time. After about 40 years, starting in the late 70s and really coming into full force in the 80s, we really moved in a different direction in terms of policy. We moved to cutting taxes for the wealthiest people, deregulating a lot of these sectors. And over time, what we saw was that there was increasing inequality, and ultimately the great crash of 2008 came at the end of this long era. And so that's the place where we are today, is still in the wake of the economic crash and the Great Recession. We're in a period where there's rising inequality, where people feel increasingly insecure, and where the middle class is shrinking and is increasingly anxious about being able to provide for their future. And it's partly a function of these economic policies that we've undertaken over the last 30 years, but partly a function of what those economic policies do to our political system, which enables the wealthiest people and corporations to set policies that benefit themselves instead of benefiting the common good.
Right. There's that fear of the founders there that if we had this class of really wealthy people, they'd have too much power over government. Do they? And if so, how does that play out?
Yeah. So, you know, John Taylor, a senator from Virginia in 1814, said that when the rich plunder the poor, it is slow and legal. And what he meant by that is what happens is when you have this kind of wealthy class of people, they use the laws to their advantage and they design the laws in their advantage, and that it just creates this kind of vicious cycle. One commentator calls it the doom loop of oligarchy, in which you just have reinforcing wealth and power. And that's not what it means to have a representative government or a representative democracy.
You mentioned progressive campaign finance reform from about a century ago, actually. Big changes lately, and you say that's due to kind of novel interpretations of the First Amendment starting in the last 30, 40 years. What happened?
So one of the things that's happened is that we've taken – the Supreme Court has taken a narrow, narrow approach to what the government is allowed to regulate as money in our campaign system. And the approach used to be that the kinds of things that would distort the political marketplace, the marketplace of ideas, could be regulated. And increasingly what the court has done is said that really they're only going to allow campaign finance regulations if there's bribery or the appearance of quid pro quo bribery. That's a much narrower kind of regulation. It becomes much harder to regulate the amount of money going into politics. And this is a really perverse thing. And it's perverse not just because there's a lot of bribery going on. In most cases, I don't think there's a lot of direct bribery going on in Congress. The real problem that we have in Congress is if you spend all your time raising money, most of the time what you're doing is you're talking to very, very wealthy people and you're hearing the concerns of very, very wealthy people. And that skews your views if you're a member of Congress to support the things that the people who you're spending your time with believe, rather than you being out there talking to ordinary constituents in your district and hearing from them what their real concerns are.
Ganesh Sitaraman is with us now talking about income inequality in the United States and how it could affect the stability of the country. He's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about his new book. It's The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Income Inequality Threatens Our Republic.
And you can join our conversation. Do you think income inequality is a threat to the stability of the country? Why or why not? And what do you think should be done to alleviate income inequality? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about the growing economic divide in the United States and why it might threaten the stability of the country. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us. He's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University and the author of The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution.
You can join the conversation. What questions do you have about economic inequality and the impact they might have on politics? What do you think could be done to solve the problem? Is there a political figure you look to as trying to solve this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So Ganesh, growing economic inequality, the worry that either the richest people are in charge of everything or everybody else has a revolution of some sort or brings a tyrant in to take their place. How worried are you at this time in American history?
Well, I think we have real concern to be worried, and it's because that this kind of change happens on the side of leaning toward oligarchy, not in one big moment. We don't revise the Constitution to say we're now an oligarchy. It happens slowly. It happens without us really noticing. And one day we wake up and we don't have the kind of free society, the republic that we wish we had and that we were supposed to have. So I think this is worrying. And I think it's worrying because the numbers that we see today about the amount of wealth going to the richest people in this country are getting wider, and they're extremely concerning. They're at rates that we haven't seen since before the Great Depression, and that's a big challenge to our society. So I'm worried about it, and I think this in some ways is the real constitutional crisis that we face right now, and it's one that can't be solved in 1 year or with one Congress or one bill. It's something that's going to take a long time for us to work through.
We'll get to some possible solutions in a few. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Fond du Lac. Jane, hi.
Hi. I want to agree with your guest that income inequality is the constitutional crisis we're facing, because that's the nub of everything. And I think that this phase we're in now began when Reagan first busted the Air Traffic Controllers Union. And I said at that time, you've just seen the beginning of the end of the middle class. And unfortunately, my prediction is borne out to be true. And I was hopeful that in this administration now, which I thought was going to be a Democratic administration and possibly control of the Senate, we could continue to unravel some of what has been done since 1982, 83. And now I'm more frightened than ever, because the swamp is deeper than ever. They're talking even within states to rewrite the United States Constitution.
Jane, I want to jump in because you've given us a lot to talk about there. Ganesh, first of all, the decline of unions, anti-union efforts, Jane says, part of the problem with inequality. Is it?
Yes, Jane's exactly right about this. I mean, unions are one of the most effective institutions in American public policy for advancing the interests of working class people. Across our history, unions have been at the forefront of fighting for working class people, not just members of unions also, by the way, but all working class people, whether or not they were in a union. And in fact, some of the studies show that of all the interest groups in Washington, the only ones that consistently advocate for the interests of working class people in this country are unions. And so the deliberate assault on the right to be able to join a union in this country over the last 30 years or so is a real problem, because it threatens the balance that we have between institutions that support the interests of working class people and many other institutions that exist in the country that support more wealthy people, whether that's corporate trade associations or others. Unions are really a core part of how we built the middle class here.
Jane, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Alice on the line in Sheboygan. Alice, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and speak about what occurred after World War II with the rise of the middle class from all these farm boys that got to go to college, and how that changed our country. And lo and behold, if many of them didn't go into engineering and become engineers, and I wish, for another rise of the middle class, and I'm afraid some promises were made by our current president to people who will never see the middle class.
Alice, thanks for the call. You had mentioned, Ganesh, the GI Bill. College funding, college education costs, big topic now. Do you think we can recreate some of what Alice says was the success of that post-World War II education initiative?
Yeah, throughout our history, education has been one of the important tickets to the middle class for people. In the 19th century, we created the land-grant colleges so that people all across the country would be able to get a college education. In the 20th century, we had the GI Bill, sending a generation to college. We had the National Defense Education Act, which created college loans to let people go to college. In the last few decades, though, what we've seen is skyrocketing college costs and debt being pushed onto and held by students. And this is a real problem, because it means that young people are deeply worried and unable to really live as adults, because they're highly burdened by these huge debt loads. It's a problem for their parents who worry about putting their kids through college. This is a serious challenge for our economy. It's also a challenge for building the middle class when we have all of this debt being pushed onto our youngest people who are entering the workforce. So I think this is a huge problem, and it's one of the things that we really need to work on right now, is making college more affordable, if not free altogether.
Alex, thanks for the call. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us now, author of The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Time for one more call. Aaron is with us in Oshkosh. Aaron, hi.
Yes, hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, very simple. I'll be succinct. Number one, citizenship aside, people need to be proactive in their citizenship. They need to be involved. We have Social Security cards. That's our federal identification number. Therefore, people should think of it kind of like a stock. We have a vested interest in this country as citizens, as stockholders, and change does not happen on its own. Change happens via sacrifice. We as a people, as a mass, as citizens, need to actively put ourselves online and get involved, or else nothing will change.
Aaron, thanks for the call. And Ganesh, that's a good segue. I wanted to talk about possible solutions here. If so much more power is being concentrated in the hands of the wealthiest, what is the ordinary citizen to do to change things?
Well, I think Aaron's exactly right about how we all need to be involved. And one of the exciting things I discovered in doing the research for this book is that people throughout our history were engaged in a sustained way at the grassroots level over many, many years. It wasn't just one march or one election, but throughout the populist and progressive era, which was the last time we really confronted levels of inequality like we're seeing today, people were very, very active. There were strike waves across the country. There were mass protests. There was lots of action to try to get change in government. And that was necessary to be able to allow the people who were in government who wanted to make change to have the wind in their sails, to have the force behind them to be able to push that change through our political process, which is designed to be difficult to get anything through. And that's what it takes. It's going to take a combination of leadership who wants to make change, but also a grassroots movement to force them to make change.
But as you lay things out with political influence, the wealthiest people are involved in selecting candidates, funding candidates, talking to candidates, lobbying candidates, and you cite some research in the book saying they have a lot more access to politicians, a lot bigger voice than the rest of Americans. How to overcome that?
Yeah, so this is one of the deep, perverse ironies of the system is the people you need to win over are the very ones who are being influenced by the wealthiest people in the country. Now, I think what's most instructive is how we got past the constitutional amendment to have the direct election of senators, because in order to do this, they had to get the Senate to agree to this amendment. And all these senators had been picked under the old model by the state legislatures. And they also had to get the state legislatures to agree to give up their power to pick senators, which is not something that people like to do. They don't want to give up their power. And so how did they do this 100 years ago? The way they did it was people went out and they asked their legislators, they asked everybody running for office to pledge to support the direct election approach, and that they would refuse to vote for people unless they did that. And that was the kind of action that it took over multiple years to try to build that movement. And when you had enough people who had pledged to do it, it happened. I think that's the kind of thing we need today is real grassroots action to push candidates to support the kind of things that will help rebuild our middle class, get money out of our political system, and really make this government a republic again.
We'll leave it there. Ganesh, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Ganesh Sitaraman is an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of the new book we've been talking about, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. He joins us today to talk about the rising tide of economic inequality in the United States and the effects he's worried it may have on our political system, on the future of representative government here in the United States. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this very big topic. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page, or if you're very succinct, tweet us at Central Time WPR.